This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. If you come to DC, you'll notice there's an interesting slogan on the license plates. It reads, "Taxation without representation." And it's a cheeky reference to the fact that DC residents pay federal taxes, but don't have a vote in Congress. That's just one of the reasons some have called for DC statehood. The debate over statehood has played out over decades. Last Friday, the House passed a bill granting DC full states' rights. It's the first time a bill like this has ever passed in Congress. But this doesn't mean that DC is suddenly a state, even though some people would really like it to be.
Hi, my name is Josiah.
Hi, my name is Janet. I'm calling from Kansas City, Missouri.
I believe that DC deserves statehood, as well as Puerto Rico and the other U.S. territories.
I have thought for years that it's ridiculous. They cannot vote. They have no vote.
They're U.S. citizens, but they don't have any ability to participate in an election, save perhaps D.C. I'm not quite familiar with that.
They should be able to vote like everybody else.
If they're American citizens, then they're effectively being denied their right to participate fully in our democracy. And I think that that's really just quite tragic.
Thank you, Josiah and Janet, for leaving us those messages. We'll talk about the complicated and racist history of why DC has never been granted statehood and what the state of New Columbia would even look like. Joining us is our own Rachel Curzius, senior editor for DCist here at WAMU. Rachel, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is George Derek Musgrove. He's a professor of American history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. George, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel, I'll start with you. Tell us, what does D.C. not being a state actually mean in practice? And what things are D.C. residents barred from doing?
That's a great question. And I'm so delighted to be able to speak with people from all over the country about why this is, because you might think that because Congress meets in DC, the residents have a say over what happens in Congress. That's largely not true, because DC doesn't have a full voting representative in the House, and it has no one in the Senate. So that means any big decision that's happening in Congress is happening without any input from people who live in DC. And so in addition to that, in addition to not being able to, for instance, have any say in who goes to the Supreme Court, what nominations pass there, we also see that there are a lot of Congress people who aren't elected by DC who decide to meddle in DC affairs. Mm-hmm. So let me give you a couple of examples of that. We've got, for instance, in 2014, DC residents voted in a local election to make recreational marijuana legal. But because Congress continues to meddle in our affairs, we can't have dispensaries, even though all of the citizens, the mayor, and other elected officials have wanted it to be so. And that's the case with a lot of our locally raised funds. We can't use them to fund reproductive care like abortion. And more recently, we've seen two huge compelling arguments that advocates have used for why DC should be a state. Back in the spring, DC was screwed out of hundreds of millions of dollars in federal relief for COVID because it wasn't treated as a state, whereas normally it is in terms of taxes. And we also saw that President Trump was able to deploy federal law enforcement and troops on the streets in DC in early June, despite the fact that local officials and residents were largely opposed to that.
Right.
So those are just some of the ways in which DC not being a state means that it gets pushed around a lot by people who really aren't accountable to the citizens who live here.
And that incident you bring up in June, Rachel, you know, people were shocked that Mayor Muriel Bowser had no control over the National Guard because she's not technically a governor, so they have to answer to the president. George, I want to bring you into the conversation, and I also want to take a step back. How did we get here? What's the history behind why DC isn't a state?
Oh, goodness. It's quite complicated, but
give it all to us in 1 minute. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, quickly. The easiest thing to say is that the framers wanted the federal district to be outside of the control of a single state. And so they wrote it into the Constitution, Section 1, Article 1, Section 8, that the Congress should have exclusive jurisdiction over the federal district. At that point, they're really not saying anything about whether or not these people vote in Congress or anything like that. They're just saying that they want control over their federal district, which should not exceed 10 miles square. So it could be shrunken down. It was when Alexandria was retroceded back to Virginia in 1846. And so district residents have fought for two different things over the course of the last 220 years. One is just home rule, to have a local government, a city council and a mayor that could just run local affairs. The other is some type of representation in Congress, either through a constitutional amendment, through retrocession back to Maryland for the part of it on this side of the Potomac, or for statehood. And probably the youngest of all those struggles is a struggle for statehood, which really picks up after about 1969 and becomes a dominant strategy for gaining a vote in Congress among D.C. residents about 1980, when city residents pass a referendum saying that statehood is their chosen strategy. It's how they want to get representation in Congress. And support for statehood is only built among both D.C. residents and members of the Democratic caucus since 1980. At the same time, it has receded almost to zero among national Republicans. And that's really been the difficulty that D.C. residents have faced in trying to get something through Congress since 1980. Mm.
Now, George, we got a couple of texts from folks who were saying things along this line here. One listener said, I was born and raised and spent the first 40 years of my life in D.C. I still consider it my home. It's a tragedy that the citizens of the district are taxed at a rate by the federal government higher than virtually any place else in the country and have never had voting representation. It's hard to believe that there is any reason for that other than D.C.'s population being majority Black for much of its existence. Here's another listener text that said, there should be no taxation without representation. Being mostly a Black city, that leaves them being disadvantaged at a much higher rate. They have no say over anything in the city. This is not right. George, D.C. has had a large Black population for a very long time. So tell us how race has played into the decision to not grant statehood.
Sure. So D.C. has had a 20% Black population at its lowest in its history, and it's had a 73% Black population at its highest in its history, and that was around 1970. And initially, you know, the Black population didn't really matter in conversations of representation in Congress because African Americans couldn't vote. In fact, they weren't citizens as far as most white Americans were concerned. And race played a huge role in the D.C. first losing any type of, the district losing any type of local government. And that was in the 1870s. With the end of Reconstruction, members of Congress and local white elites conspired to strip the city of any vote at all. And it remained that way for the next 100 years. And if you look at the arguments against the return of either home rule or representation in Congress during that 100-year period, the basic argument from national leaders as well as local white leaders in the business community and elites more generally is, if we bring that back the vote, Black people will have access to the franchise and they'll dominate the city. And this is even when African Americans are only 30% of the population around the turn of the century. After 1957, when D.C. gets a Black majority, segregationists in Congress are dead set against any type of vote in the city, home rule or representation in Congress. And so you have people like Senator Byrd from West Virginia, who just flat out is opposed to any type of franchise in D.C. One, because he could be pretty racist at that point in his political career, but also because he was using jobs in D.C. as a works program for unemployed people in West Virginia. So if you lost your job in the mine, come work in D.C. as a police officer. And he'd literally have, you know, people working on hiring offices in his district offices in West Virginia. Since, though, the Republican Party has really just focused on maintaining an advantage in Congress. And so they have been dead set against increasing what were guaranteed to be two guaranteed Democratic seats from D.C. in the Senate, one more in the House. And they used to whisper it in back rooms. And so Pat Buchanan even said in 1979 at a conference of conservative activists, look, we can't say this out loud. D.C. residents have a raw deal, but we absolutely can't let them get two seats in the Senate because that will disadvantage us. Mm-hmm. But he said that behind closed doors. Fast forward to 2016, and John Kasich said that openly, and President Trump has tweeted a bunch of times since.
We're talking with George Derek Musgrove, professor of history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and Rachel Kersey, a senior editor of DCist at WAMU. Rachel, why should someone in California or Montana care about D.C. statehood? Tell us what the debate playing out here in the nation's capital means for the rest of the country.
That really depends on who that person is, mm-hmm. because even within D.C., we're seeing a difference of strategy emerging in how people want to show or express why D.C. should be a state. And so among really local activists, what they're saying is, this is plain unfair. It's ridiculous, the idea that living in D.C., being born in D.C. or choosing to move here, and yes, a lot of people are born in D.C., and there are 706,000 residents currently, that it's not fair that they shouldn't have any representation in Congress, and that there are really negative consequences of that lack of representation. And so that argument tries to appeal to people's morals, to people's ethics. That's mm-hmm. gone okay. as you can see, D.C. hasn't become a state yet. And part of it is because a lot of people plain don't know about D.C.'s kind of peculiar limbo when it comes to representation. But what we saw, particularly after 2016, and I just want to set the scene for you really quickly about this, because 2016 was in D.C., an election in which people were very excited because that's when they voted overwhelmingly that they wanted to become a state. And they also voted overwhelmingly 94% for Hillary Clinton, who said full-throatedly that she wanted to support D.C. statehood. Instead, Donald Trump won that election. And we saw suddenly a lot of national activists, a lot of national progressive activists saying that D.C. statehood was one of the ways that they could work on what they saw as an imbalance in the Senate. The idea, for instance, that rural areas are represented so much more than urban areas, mm-hmm. just structurally in the Senate, and that having D.C. as a state would help with that. And so there's a little bit of tension there between people saying, you know, it doesn't matter if D.C. would vote in Republicans or Democrats or independents. We just want them to be able to vote, versus people saying, look, if you're progressive, mm-hmm. if you're liberal, there's a strategy in trying to make sure that D.C. folks are enfranchised, because ultimately it will help you. I mean, think about some of those really close votes in the Senate. For instance, when John McCain very dramatically said, like, no, we're not going to end the Affordable Care Act. If D.C. had senators, it never would have come to that point in the first place. And so that's the argument that you're certainly hearing from progressive activists across the country trying to rally people in support of statehood. But certainly, as they're rallying progressives and liberals, it's very off-putting to Republicans on that same token.
Now, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton opposes D.C. statehood. Here's what he said about the effort last Thursday.
The founders created Washington as a federal city so that the operations of government would be safe and free from domination by the states around it. The wisdom of this decision was on display just days ago when violent riots erupted near the White House, setting fire to a historic church. If most of Washington was under the control not of the federal government, but of a left-wing politician like Muriel Bowser, who frequently takes the side of rioters against law enforcement, would you trust Mayor Bowser to keep Washington safe if she were given the powers of a governor?
Last month, Trump also told the New York Post that Republicans would be, quote, very, very stupid, unquote, to let a majority Democratic city like D.C. become a state. Real quick, Rachel, let us know how much of this debate is about politics.
Well, to D.C. residents, it's about far more than politics. But certainly when you're looking at how Republicans have opposed D.C. statehood for so long, it's very clear that they're counting the votes there. When I watched the hearing about the bill that ultimately passed last Friday in the House, many Republicans were saying, for instance, D.C. is too corrupt, or which is silly if you think about it. I mean, you know, how many Illinois governors have gone to jail? But Illinois still has two senators, even though a governor literally tried to sell one of those Senate seats. And so a lot of these questions. There's also this question of constitutionality. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that where the federal government works is not allowed to be a state. Well, under this bill, the federal government, the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, the monuments, those would continue to be federal property. It's just that all of the places where people live would then be represented by two senators and a member of a full voting member of Congress. So it is very much about politics because, as President Trump kind of said the quiet part loud, he said, you know, Republicans would have to be stupid to let this happen because it would mean more Democrats in Congress.
We got just about a minute to go here, George. You know, there's been, as we said, this push for D.C. statehood for decades. Why has statehood not happened yet? And tell us, is this moment in the statehood debate different?
Yes, it absolutely is. I think what Rachel pointed out a moment ago is that, you know, the big difference this time around is that Democrats are moving almost in lockstep towards a statehood cause. If you look at the last time that statehood came up for a vote in Congress, it was 1993, and it only got about 153 votes. Now, only one Republican voted for that bill. That means that 40% of Democrats voted against that bill. And they had all types of reasons. Big states didn't want another small state, et cetera. In 2020, when it goes before the House, all Republicans oppose it, and only one Democrat opposes the bill. So that means that the Democratic Party has shifted entirely into the statehood camp, including people like Steny Hoyer, who opposed it in the past and supports it now. And so this is definitely a different moment. But Democrats will have to win the Senate and the presidency for it to get through after November.
One listener texted, D.C. statehood is an interesting proposition, but it's not like anyone is forced to live in D.C. Another member of the 1A text club said, D.C. is a special population. It is not equivalent to a state by any conventional criteria. This whole issue is a political power play to get two Democratic senators and one Democratic representative. If the D.C. voters must have representation, then revert the area back to Maryland. We are talking with Rachel Curzius, senior editor for DCist at WAMU, and George Derek Musgrove, the co-author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. Thanks so much to both of you. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. More from our guests and from you in just a moment. Stay with us. Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
There are only 5 months to go until Election Day, and every week, or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
Now let's bring in two new voices to the conversation on D.C. statehood. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton is D.C.'s representative. Congresswoman, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And David Schleicher is a professor of law at Yale University and author of the essay Welcome to New Columbia, The Fiscal, Economic, and Political Consequences of Statehood for D.C. David, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congresswoman, your position as D.C.'s representative is interesting, given D.C.'s status. What do you do as representative? And tell us, what power do you have if you can't vote in Congress?
Well, it's interesting to note that actually I have every other single power except that final vote on the House floor. And let me tell you what that means.
Yeah.
I can chair a subcommittee. I do chair one now. I can chair a full committee. I vote in committee. I do everything that every representative does. But when it comes time to cast that final vote, including votes that affect only the District of Columbia, every member of the House of Representatives can vote except the member who has been elected by the residents of the District of Columbia.
So what does it feel like to never be able to vote on final passage for one of your bills?
Well, frankly, I've never felt disembembered in the Congress because I walked in the door saying I'm going to act like every other member of Congress and demand to be treated like every other member of Congress, and I have. It's not me. The problem is with the people I represent. I get all the respect I need in Congress, but they get no respect when that final vote comes and everybody can cast a vote except the member who represents them.
Now, D.C. statehood has been central to your platform for decades. Can you tell us why it's so important to you?
it's important to me and personally and as a member. Personally, because I'm a third-generation Washingtonian. My great-grandfather was a runaway slave. He got here to freedom, but nobody in the Holmes family has made it to equality. Far beyond that, though, it's important to me because I represent Americans who pay the highest federal taxes per capita and have no vote in the House of Representatives. That's an amazing notion when you think about it, because highest per capita means more than in the largest states and the richest states like New York and California. Indeed, we pay more federal taxes than 22 states. That's what we contribute to the United States of America without having a vote. If you look at the district, and people will say, well, you know, that's just a city. Well, it's larger than two states, Wyoming and Vermont. And they say, well, certainly it's not in fiscal terms equal. Well, we have a budget of almost $16 billion. That's larger than the budget of 14 states. Mm-hmm. And if you want to look at whether or not we are ready to be a state, as we have been since the nation was created, but yeah. Here's some dollars and cents for you. Our AAA bond rating is better than that of 35 states who can count themselves.
Well, let's bring in David Schleicher, professor of law at Yale University. David, what do you think are the potential problems with D.C. statehood?
So the case for D.C. statehood has always been very focused on Congress and the effect statehood would have on providing representation in Congress. But for D.C.'s residents, the biggest effect would not be in having representation in Congress, but rather in changing the form of their own government. D.C. as a state would be quite unique. It would be the only state that is entirely in one metropolitan area, and it would even beyond that just be the city and not have control over its own suburbs or any of its own suburbs. And this would be unique among the states. This would have pretty big effects on it as a fiscal entity, its taxing and spending, its economy, and on its politics. I think statehood is a good idea, all things told, but that proponents need to think really hard about how to shape statehood in order to address these problems.
What do you say to that, Congresswoman?
I've heard lots of arguments against statehood, but I must say to the professor, that's unique. It is true that this would be a unique state. It wouldn't be like every other state. It wouldn't have what he calls a metropolitan area or suburbs. But that has nothing to do with statehood. Statehood ought to be about whether in every single respect, with respect to the other states, you are entitled to statehood. Now, if you want to look and see about suburbs, we have suburbs here. And they, in fact, vote or are treated in many ways as a metropolitan area. That's what would happen if we became a state. So if we get hung up on something as trivial as a state has to look like this, a state has to have these things, then we have lost sight of the Constitution and of the latitude that the framers gave us to form states.
We got this voicemail from a listener about why they think D.C. shouldn't be a state. Here's Bob from Lancaster.
Washington, D.C. cannot be a state because the Constitution forbids it. The desire to have Washington, D.C. as a state is just a power grab by the Democrats.
Thank you, Bob, for leaving us that voicemail. David, is Bob right? Would making D.C. a state be unconstitutional?
No. The analysts from conservatives like Viet Dinh to the ACL, liberal organizations like the ACLU, have gone through this issue extensively, and the legal arguments against statehood are silly. There'd be a small problem created by the fact that the 23rd Amendment allocates electoral votes to districts, and the district would then be shrunk to a very small area by statehood, which would leave three electoral votes in the hands of a very small number of people. But other than that, the arguments about that Maryland needs sign-off because the land was given from Maryland to create the district, people think have very little merit. And so there's no real constitutional problem. The question is about advisability much more than it is about the law.
David, your response to an email here from Stephen. D.C., the state, would be the only fully urban jurisdiction in Congress. Residents of cities around the country, even mid-sized and small cities, would gain a new ally in expressing their concerns on a wide range of issues. This will be especially valuable for urban residents of Republican states like Louisville, Kentucky, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Phoenix, Arizona, Houston, Texas, and so on.
Yeah, so I think DC statehood would be very salutary for Congress. The big question I have, and I think this is something that could be dealt with in a state constitution, is the fact that DC would be kind of almost uniquely shock prone as a state, and it would not have the federal government standing behind it the way that it did when DC faced its fiscal crisis in the mid 90s. The city would, you know, if there was a decline in demand for urban property, or the federal government shrunk by a certain percentage just, you know, because of politics or whatever, you could see a really major fiscal shock to a city that couldn't balance against it being able to tax the suburbs, or couldn't balance against having another metropolitan city in its state. And so I think that those are the questions of downside. For the effect on Congress, I think it would be quite good. It is, in fact, the case that the U.S. Senate particularly is biased towards rural areas, the House, too, to some degree, and that D.C. statehood would help push against that.
Congresswoman, you heard the voicemail that we played a moment ago from Bob. He said that D.C. statehood is a power grab by Democrats. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that that's the fear, and I can understand that fear because most big cities are Democratic, and that indeed is what is on the mind of Republicans. And then the country has to ask itself, is admission to the union dependent upon the politics of those who seek admission? And if your answer is yes, then you don't want any state admitted until you do a poll and see how they would vote. So we recognize that that is a challenge to us. We're prepared to meet that challenge. And let me give you an example of how we're going to meet it. We look at the election coming up, where you see the president opposed to statehood and the Senate opposed to statehood. And then we look at what the polls are showing, recognizing fully that polls can change. But they are so overwhelming that we are heartened by the fact that it looks like Democrats will take the Senate, and it almost surely looks like we will have a new president of the United States. So those who look at a moment in time to try to figure what will happen with a specific bill need to read their history.
Well, let's take a quick break, but we'll talk more about DC statehood with our guests right after this. This is 1A.
I'm Gregory Warner with NPR's Rough Translation. So there's a holiday in the Netherlands where every year thousands of white folks wear blackface. Some people are trying to end that tradition, but in a very Dutch way.
You talk until you reach consensus.
Can you fight racism in a way that brings the whole country with you? That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
Hi, this is Greg from Pennsylvania. It makes no sense to add another tiny state. Washington, D.C. isn't even a big city. If anything, make it part of Maryland or Virginia, not a state of its own.
Thanks, Greg. Congresswoman, you hear this one a lot. How do you respond to it?
Actually, I don't hear it a lot. And the reason I don't hear it a lot is because there are two states that are smaller or would be smaller if the district became a state, Vermont and Wyoming.
Right.
We've never looked at to see what your size was to see whether or not you should be admitted to the union. People need to focus on what D.C. would add It is a very thriving city. We have so many people that we have no place to go. Indeed, you know, you can't build above a certain level in D.C., which makes it expensive to live here. Talking about being able to support ourselves, that, of course, means that the district must tax people because it can't make up for it by expanding. So the district recognizes that, and still people come because it is a place to live that people find desirable.
One listener texted, taxation without representation was a major reason for the revolution and founding of this country. It's asinine that D.C. doesn't have representation in the legislature. David, what would D.C. actually look like as a state? What would some of the features be?
Well, I mean, so it would be quite unique as a state. It would be the only state without local governments internal to it. It would be, it's just a city. And again, it is would be a small, not the smallest, as the Congresswoman notes, but it would be quite a small state. The one of the big things that would be attractive about statehood, I think, is that it would give D.C. greater capacity to engage in kind of remove the limitations created by the Home Rule Act that were quite odd and bad. And the Congressman mentioned one of them, which is the enshrinement of the Height of Buildings Act, which stops D.C. from removes from D.C. the ability to approve taller buildings. And as a result, office space in D.C. is extraordinarily expensive, and residences are extraordinarily expensive because D.C. doesn't have full rights to allow construction. Further, statehood would give D.C. the power to tax out-of-state residents who work in the city. And this has always been one of the major oppositions that politicians from Maryland and Virginia have had to D.C. statehood. That power would be granted. D.C. would also lose some things, though. D.C. got a bunch of special benefits, particularly in the 90s, as part of the kind of bailout of city government that it would lose. And so D.C. would get and lose from statehood as a governing entity.
And we are almost out of time, but Congresswoman, I want to read this tweet to you and give you just about 30 seconds or so to respond. They said, please ask about the way the feds hold the D.C. budget hostage year after year, forcing D.C. to issue bonds to cover its own money. I would appreciate you expanding on this economic interrelation.
What she's referring to is that our budget, raised here entirely in the District of Columbia, has to go to be signed off by the Congress of the United States. Absurd, because they don't put a dime in that budget. And this is the kind of anomaly that we've been trying to get rid of through just getting full home rule. So there are probably more benefits to the country, not to mention to the district. If we were to be a state, it is important for me to say one important thing, and that is one of your listeners talked about Maryland and Virginia and that they could be taxed. Please note that all four senators from our two adjoining states, Maryland and Virginia, are sponsors of the D.C. statehood bill. They know they could face some possible taxation. That is always negotiated with the entity involved.
In a minute to go, David, you think that proponents of statehood have been far too focused on Congress. So tell us, what should they be focused on instead if they actually want to make this happen?
They should be focused on making D.C. as a state work. And I think that this would require a state constitution that was designed to solve the particular problems of D.C. as a state. And so I think they need to include in their state, though they ought to consider including in their state constitution, rules governing kind of a mandatory contributions to a rainy day fund that are stricter than most places, given the new state's capacity for kind of booms and busts. And they should focus on, or they should consider adding to their electoral rules, things designed to create internal electoral competition so that the local officials face kind of partisan competition inside the city. It's not going to come from national political parties, but from some degree, or that would create some degree of internal competition.
David Schleicher is a professor of law at Yale University, and D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. Thank you both for joining us. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.